listeners. This is the Fireside Chat. How many people have heard the podcast interview I did with Bexted a couple months ago? Okay, pretty decent number. Yeah, I'm going to try not to not repeat that, push on from some of the topics that we raised there.
Cool.
So the first question I had was, back in 2012, like since 2012, it's been a distinct movement, I think, towards focusing on existential risk and long-term future causes.
Yeah.
But it's not as if there's been a lot of arguments that we had that we weren't aware of in 2012. In a sense, we've just become more confident that or we're more willing to make this kind of contrarian bet that thinking about the very long-term future is the most impactful thing to do. And I'm curious to know whether you think we should have made that switch earlier, whether we were too averse to doing something that was weird and unconventional that other like people in general society might not have respected or understood.
Yeah, it's a good question. I would, I guess I would say partly that I think some things have changed that have made it more attractive, but I mostly think we should have like gone in more boldly on those issues sooner and had a sufficient case to do so. I think like the main thing that have changed is with AI in particular, the sense of progress in the field has taken off and it's become a bit more tangible for that reason. But mostly I agree that like we could have gone in earlier and I regret that. I think like you know the things that we spending money to grow work in that field sooner, I think could have been would have been better spent than like what the effective altruist community is likely to spend its like its last dollars on. And I wish the field was larger today. And so that I think that was a mistake. And I guess if you try to ask like why did we make that mistake, I think you're probably pointing in roughly the right direction. Like it's uncomfortable to do something super weird, and you know, I think there was, and I don't know, I guess different people would have different answers. I think that I think I probably, if I introspect on myself and I say why didn't I come into this like more boldly earlier, and I include myself in the group of people who could have, I think it, you know, there was a sense of like, wow, that's pretty crazy. Am I ready for that?
Yeah.
What are people going to think?
Yeah, there were. Well, people came up with all these stories for why working on reducing poverty or helping animals in the standard ways that we'd been doing before were also the best ways to help the long-term future, which struck me as very suspicious arguments at the time, because they seemed like rationalizations for just not changing anything based on what could be like a really crucial consideration. I mean, do you think that there's anything that we might be doing like that today? Do you think that they were actually rationalizations, or were they like good considerations that we had to work through?
I mean, I think it's true that a lot of ways we could do good now, including like addressing global poverty, I think you could make a case that it has a positive effect on the long-term future. And if I was going to guess the sign, that's the sign I would guess. I don't think that like donating to you know the usual suspects, AMF and such, would be like my leading guess for how you're going to like change the long-term character of the future in the best way possible. So, you know, yeah, so I don't know. I don't want to psychologize other people's like reasons for coming up with that view. I would be like guessing elsewhere for that. And I don't know, could we be making other mistakes like that today? I don't see one. I think like there's ones you could say maybe we're doing that for. Like maybe you could make a case like, oh, are we doing that with like infinite ethics or something? There's not much of a debate about that. But like,
seems like it could be another crucial consideration that could really switch things around.
It could be. I mean, according to me, I would say like if I was doing the thing that was best for infinite ethics, it would look a lot like, you know, the stuff I'm doing for global catastrophic risks. But
isn't that really suspicious? Why is that?
I don't find it that suspicious. Like, you know, like one reason to think about that is like, I think that a lot of the stuff on like AI and biosecurity preparations, like when I run the numbers, I think the like expected cost per life saved is like right up there with like the best ways of just like helping humans. I think these are like big deal things in the world, and they're not just big deals if you have like an astronomical waste, you know, worldview. And so, you know, so I think they weather a storm from just like help the most humans to do the best thing for astronomical waste. So like it wouldn't be that weird if they were also do the best thing for like, you know, infinite good outcomes. I think that's less tight there, but I mean, if I was going to explain the argument a little bit more, I would say like, well, okay, if there's a way of like achieving infinite good, then either it's a scalable process where you want more of it, or it's a process where you just like want to get it once. If it's a scalable process where you want more of it, then it's going to be some physical process that could be discoverable by like a completed science. And then that's kind of like the same astronomical waste argument applies to that, because that's where all the possible resources are, is in the distant future, and we'll probably unlock that if we kind of like nail that problem.
Yeah.
And conversely, if it's a thing where, you know, you just get it once, I don't have any good candidates available right now for like how we're going to like, you know, achieve infinite value through some esoteric means. And my bet would be on like, you know, a more developed civilization with a completed science finding it. So like, want to make sure we get there.
We could at least tell people about it a bit more.
We could.
If it seemed that decisive, yeah.
We could.
We'd have some infinite ethics promotion advocacy group. That would be pushing the boundaries, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe bad for the rest of the movement. Over that amount of time as well, there's been a movement among mainstream AI researchers to take alignment issues seriously. But they seem to have been fairly slow to get on board. And even now, it seems like we're making decent progress on concrete technical questions. But it's not as if people are stampeding into joining this effort, people who've been doing other mainstream capabilities research before.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? And are there things that we could have done differently or could do differently now?
Yeah, why is the AI community not doing all the things it could do on taking technical safety seriously as a problem? I think that's a difficult question. I think partly it's a matter of time, and it's a matter of like of timelines and what people believe, how far away they believe powerful AI systems are. I think that's a big chunk of it. I also think a big chunk of it is that some of the work involves motivations that are kind of unusual, and are unusual for thinking about like with like the sort of like lens you would have as like a machine learning researcher. Like I think, for example, you know, I think Paul Cristiano does a lot of really excellent work on AI alignment as a problem, and he blogs about it. And a lot of his blog posts are not really shaped like machine learning papers. I think like fields tend to get organized around successful methodologies and people who have employed those methodologies successfully. And like sets of problems that are interesting. I think machine learning is like a field that likes empirical results and, you know, explaining them what you did with some code and what the empirical results were. And I think a lot of the issues that like come into play when you're trying to think well about AI safety, AI alignment, I think there are some things that like fit that and people do them and it's great. I think there are a lot of things that like say Paul writes about that don't fit that. And I think a lot of the things that you would have to consider to like be properly motivated to work on the problem might have a little bit of the character of not shaped like a machine learning paper. And I think that makes it hard to move things forward. And I think that's a hard problem to think about.
Yeah. Do you think that's a big mistake that fields are making if they're so resistant to like ideas about their field that come from outside? Is that defensible because it helps them avoid nonsense that would otherwise creep in?
I mean, I might reframe resistant to ideas that come from the outside. Yeah. I think you know fields are organized around like a topic, set of problems, and some methodologies, and you know, new methodologies, I think, tend to get accepted when people come in and use a new methodology to do something really impressive that, by the standards of the field, solve some recalcitrant, interesting problem. I'm basically expressing, like, a Kuhnian view about, like, philosophy of science. And I think there's a lot to that, and it keeps out pseudoscience. And I think it, like, helps keep things rigorous, and there's, like, a valuable function to be played there. But I think because some of the approaches to like thinking about the motivations behind like AI safety as a technical problem aren't so much shaped like a machine learning paper, I think it does set off people's like pseudoscience alarm bells. And I think that makes it harder to like move forward in the way that I wish things would.
Yeah. Seems like this was an issue with concerns about nanotechnology as well, maybe in the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
And I guess maybe less of an issue with concerns about synthetic biology. It seems like maybe those concerns have come from within the field as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the case of nanotechnology is a harder one, and I feel like less sure what to think about it overall. But I do think, you know, insofar as I have looked into that, say Eric Drexler's work on nanosystems, I haven't seen anything that I would call like a decisive refutation of that, and I've seen things that were offered as decisive refutations. Yeah. I think I have like a pretty reasonable odds that like something like that is in principle possible. I feel uncertain about like what to think about the field's view of that, but I do place substantial probability on like, you know, that being a case of interesting work that was like on the turf of another discipline and didn't kind of like conform to the like reigning methodologies and like successfully like reasoned its way to a novel conclusion, but not a conclusion that was like of substantial interest to the field in the right way and like provable using like what they would normally consider the way to do science to like make it become sort of socialized and accepted. I do think it's an interesting like test bed for thinking about like the sociology of that field and how fields work with their intellectual norms. I mean, it's a little weird to talk about whether they're being irrational in this respect, because like in some sense I think like these are sort of like spontaneous orders that arise and it's not like designed by one person. They're kind of hard to change, and like their fashion plays a big role in fields, and I think that's like clear to anybody who's like been a grad student.
Do you think if we're interested in changing views within fields in future, that we should try to pair launching our views with some kind of technical accomplishment, some engineering result that they might respect?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think it's a hard question ultimately. Like, yeah, I mean, if you took the strict Kuhnian view and you said, okay, well, how do you change the paradigm of a field? Yeah, you have to like come in with some revolutionary accomplishment. That's like a tall order.
Yeah.
I think you can do things that are like interesting by the standards of the field, and also are interesting for your kind of unusual motivation, and like that is also a route to like legitimizing a topic.
Mm. Okay, what career options that are very promising do you think EAs are neglecting to take sufficiently?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't like, I wouldn't say this is like underrated by the EA community right now, but like it is striking to me that we still don't have that many people from our community who are say working on technical AI safety at OpenAI or DeepMind, and we don't have that many people from our community who are working as like policy advisors at those organizations. And you know, it seems to me that, you know, if you're trying to be prepared for a world in which like transformative AGI might be developed over the next 15 or 20 years, then that's an unfortunate oversight. I think those roles are hard to get, that's understandable. But I think like, you know, we should be making a strong effort for that. I think also roles as like research engineers working on AI safety would also be pretty valuable. Those might not require like going and getting a PhD in machine learning. I think that's like something that a really good software engineer could think about retooling for and could successfully end up doing and could have a really big impact.
You were telling me about someone who recently managed to get into OpenAI, right, as a software developer? Or they were a software developer, then within a couple of months of training, they managed to get a job there as an engineer?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think like there's more room for that kind of thing. What else is striking to me? I think it's striking. I think Jason Matheny's career is very striking to me. This is somebody who's been a part of the effective altruism community, who's now the director of IARPA, and has, you know, had, I think, some pretty interesting impacts, you know, supporting the Good Judgment Project and the competition around forecasting in the intelligence community that I think has developed some really useful techniques that could be more widely applied in society. I saw like the other day, something in the news talking about like a set of questions that like is now asked whenever new projects are funded at IARPA that include, you know, what will the effects be if we're working on this and another country acquires this technology? How long will it take, and what will the effects be, and can we prepare defensive countermeasures? And it was like a new set of questions that was like asked of everything that they're funding, because that was one of his ideas, and I think it's a great idea. I'm struck by the fact that we don't have more people looking for opportunities like that in the US government. And I think we could. I would love it if more people in our community tried to get roles as program managers at IARPA or DARPA and tried to fund some awesome and relevant science along the way, and also develop their networks and be in a place where they could play an important role if some of the like transformative technologies that we're interested in start getting closer to having a big impact on the world.
What's the deal with Matheny? Like, he was one of the first kind of proto, or he's like an EA in the early 2000s, like long before the name was, we came up with that. And then he's like, he sat on this path and has been enormously successful. Is it just a selection effect that the people who like get involved in a new set of ideas very early on tend to be extremely driven? Or has he just gotten very lucky maybe? Or were we lucky to have someone so talented?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the answer to that is. Like, yeah. You could imagine that, like, you could imagine, I mean, a story that I'm just making up right now would be like, well, there's a lot of things that I think like are better explained now. And if you were kind of figuring everything out back then and you managed to like get to a lot of the crucial considerations on your own, that's kind of a stronger filter. I could imagine like other social considerations and stuff like that, but, ultimately, I think the interesting thing is like, hey, maybe we could try some more of this strategy.
Yeah.
Other ones, like, I'm also struck by, you know, I mentioned Tetlock just a moment ago. I'm struck by the fact that we don't have more people just going and being PhD students with Tetlock. I think like just like learning that methodology and deploying it somewhere else, maybe in the government, maybe at like an org like Open Philanthropy or something like that, seems like a promising route for somebody to take.
Yeah, do you worry that kind of improving decision-making stuff is just too indirect?
I mean, you could make that case. I think you can apply it relatively directly. If you had that view, suppose you had a view like, well, look, what I really care about is like AI and biosecurity preparedness. You could just take the methodology and apply it to like AI and biosecurity relevant forecasting, and I think that would be pretty valuable for the specific cause in question.
Yeah, it's really annoying no one's done that. I was like, just get like forecasting numbers. So if anyone's listening and wants to do that, so all of those paths are pretty competitive, and the EA community sometimes is accused of being elitist.
Yeah,
do you think we are elitist, and if so, is it a mistake or not? I mean, what is elitism, maybe? We need to define our terms first.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that would be partly my question. I think, so like, why would someone make that critique? I think, like, you know, you might make, I think if you see a bunch of people talking about charity and they're like talking about these kind of out there ideas, very intellectual, I think we used to be like a little bit unnecessarily combative about like other approaches to doing good. I think like, you know, that might be part of the cause of why somebody might look at what we're doing and say it's elitist. Ultimately, I think like those choices I think those choices, as I see it, are driven, and also I think it's partly self-reinforcing. So you have like a community that has like grown up to a significant degree in like Oxford and San Francisco and Berkeley, and so there's the people, the kind of like there's a bit of a founder effect, and we kind of cater to the people who pay attention to us, and so you know you end up with a lot of people who like have technical backgrounds, went to really good schools, and were thinking about the problems that we can best solve. So, and I think when I look at all the problems that we're most interested in, I think you know the paths to impact often do look research driven, egg-heady, technocratic, and so I think we shouldn't. We shouldn't like change our cause selection or views about like what is a good solution in response to what is ultimately a kind of social criticism about being elitist. But I do think do we have something to learn about how we're talking about what we're doing and like taking an attitude of humility towards that? I think maybe.
Yeah. So there's one way that we could have ended up focusing on these exclusive positions mistakenly would be. If our question is like, how can one person have the biggest impact? And so we look for like very difficult roles where that person's incredibly influential. And then we look at causes where one person can have a lot of impact. But then as a result, we can't really achieve very much scale because there's only like a small fraction of people who are ever qualified to take those roles. And if we'd said like, what are roles that as a whole, given the number of people who can end up taking them, would have the largest social impact, then you might say, well, here's like a position where there's like a million different roles or something like, well, there's a million different, there's a huge like room for more talent basically.
Yeah.
And whether each person is less useful as a whole, they'll have a larger impact.
Yeah, I think it's a legit question, and I think your answer to that question might depend on your like cause selection to some degree. So, yeah. I mean, this interview and my personal priorities are like focused more heavily on like global catastrophic risks, and I think that I think it's harder to think of something that you know takes a much larger number of people and like as an input and helps a lot with like the future of artificial intelligence. I think less about some of these other areas, and I think it would be in some ways a more interesting question that somebody else might be able to answer better. Like, well, if we were doing something at huge scale with global poverty, if you had like a Teach for America of global poverty or something, meaning like you know a thing that takes on huge numbers of like college graduates and places them in a role where they're doing something effective about the problem and has huge room for more talent. Like, that's an interesting idea. I haven't really thought it through, and like maybe there's something there. Similarly, like, you know, could you do something with that in animal welfare? I don't know the answer, and I would sort of like, you know, defer to somebody who's like more involved in that space. But I think for like for AI and biosecurity, I think that like smaller community, technocratic, more kind of artisanal job spec is like the place that it seems like it makes the most sense to be looking.
Yeah. So one reason that you don't want tons of people in those fields and it's quite artisanal is that there's a pretty high risk of people who are somewhat amateurish causing harm.
I think that's very true.
Yeah. Do you think that we're sufficiently worried about people causing harm in their career? I mean, 80,000 hours, perhaps, should we be advising more or fewer people to go into those fields?
I don't know. 80,000 hours like seems like roughly in the right place on that to me. I think there's some subtlety to like projects we take on, like in the effective altruism community. I think there's a way you can evaluate your project that makes it perhaps a little too easy to make it seem like you're doing well, which would be like, well, this is our staff, this is like our budget, this is you know the number of people we helped, and say like, well, if we value our time at X and blah 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 blah, then like the return on investment is good. I think many things do take up like a slot in the sense that, you know, well, there's probably only going to be one EA community organizer in this city, or one maybe EA community organizer organizing group in the city. Or maybe there's only going to be one like EA career advisor group or something like that. And we should be mindful of like, you know, who else might have been in that slot and what would their impact be. And that can be a way to sort of make it easier than it would seem to have negative impact by doing something that like seems pretty good.
Because you can display something that would have been better that you never kind of never perceive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. So I think we've got another five minutes or so. I'm curious to know what you think about kind of the debate that was happening earlier this year around epistemic humility. You wrote this quite popular post on Less Wrong, I think 5 years ago, where you staked out a pretty strong view on epistemic humility in favor of kind of taking the outside view and not taking your own like personal intuitions that seriously.
Yeah.
It seems that there's been maybe a bit of, there's been some controversy about that, people pushing back, saying that that doesn't generalize very well. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, the motivation for that view is kind of like, if you take the sort of like, in philosophy, they have this sort of like conciliatory views about peer disagreement, where you're kind of like supposed to be like the average of people. Like if there's a disagreement, in some sense, your view should be like an impartial combination of the views of other people who take that view seriously or have thought about that, and maybe some weighting based on like how likely you are to be right versus them in disagreements of this kind. That post was kind of like a macro, it was kind of like the macro consequences of if you took that seriously, what would that imply? Another kind of framing that motivates it would be like, well, you know, you could think of yourself, we could think of all of us as like thermometers of truth in some sense. Like you throw questions at us and we get a belief about them and we don't totally know how good our thermometers are. And I have one and you have one and everybody else has one. And we're like, which of these, what should we do when these thermometers give us different answers? And the view I defended was kind of like, yeah, you should be some impartial combination of like the output of what you think the other thermometers would have said about this question, where you're weighting by, you know, factors that you would think would indicate reliability. I think I basically still hold that. There was a secondary recommendation in that post that was like, you know, why don't you test how well you're doing by, you know, explaining your view to other people and seeing how much of it they buy. And if you're only getting like some weird niche of people to agree with you, then like maybe you should think twice about whether you're on the right track. In some sense, I think that's still like a useful activity, but I think these cases where you can only convince some weird niche of people that you're on the right track, but you're still right, are like more common than I used to think. And I think partly some of the remarks I made earlier about like the structure of intellectual fields like is an input to my views about how that can happen. I'm walking back from that test being like very decisive about like how likely it is that you're on the right track. I also, you know, I don't know, there was some things that, you know, Eliezer Yudkowsky wrote a nice book about this, and I think there's a part of that that I really agree with, which is that you might not be able to know, it might be very hard to tell who's being irrational. Somebody else might have some arguments that you can't really follow, and they might in fact be right, even if, you know, you meet up and talk about whether that's the case, and you're not, and like, you know, for all the world, it seems like one of them's more reasonable. So I don't think I have a lot of like super practical advice, but I do feel like it's possible to go too far in that direction. Another thought on that is just something about like, I think it may also be important for personal development to not be too overly modest about developing your own opinions about how things work. I think if you don't develop your own opinions about how things work and see them tested and refined and figure out how much to trust yourself, then it becomes hard to do things that are like important and innovative and be one of the first ones to kind of arrive at an important insight. So I said something about that in that post, but I think I would, if I was writing it again today, I would emphasize it more.
Yeah. All right. My guest today has been Nick Bexted. Thanks for coming on the Fireside Chat, Nick.
Thanks.